from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum this morning, San Francisco-based Twitter went public last week with its initial public offering of $26 per share, quickly jumping to $45, giving the company a $31.5 billion valuation. But according to New York Times tech writer Nick Bilton, it wasn't always smooth sailing to the top for the microblogging company. In his new book, Hatching Twitter, he explores the rocky history of its founders and the company's complicated rise to fame and fortune. Join us for Forum. That's next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. With the initial public offering Thursday of Twitter, much attention has been focused on the company and its rise from the ashes of a struggling podcasting startup called Odeo to become a multi-billion dollar business centered in San Francisco. This morning's opening Forum hour, we talk about the Twitter story with New York Times columnist and reporter Nick Bilton, who heads the New York Times Bits and Blog and who recently published Hatching Twitter, a true story of money, power, friendship, and betrayal. He joins us in studio for this opening hour, and welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Glad to have you here. And I should say initially to listeners, this is a story of four friends. By 2013, these 140 characters had close to 300 million users. It's really an amazing story and a dramatic story, even a kind of soap opera story. But before we get to the story itself, can you update us on the IPO? Where are things now?
Well, the company went public last week on Thursday, and the stock started out at 26 and almost doubled by the end of the day. And now it started to kind of drop a little bit, I think, right before I came on. It was in the $40 range, give or take. And the company was originally valued at around $15 billion. And by the IPO, it was $25 billion, which was quite dramatic.
This is a company that learned a great deal from Facebook's mistakes.
That's correct, yeah. So Facebook, everyone said Facebook was worth $50 billion and they went out at $100 billion. And I think everyone said with Twitter, they're probably worth around $18 to $20 billion and they went out at around $13 to $15 billion. And I think that it's, you know, where it is right now, which is around an $18 billion valuation, is probably accurate. I think anything over that is not right just yet.
You know, there are some people, and they're not only in the tech world, who look at this with utter amazement and disbelief. This is a company that doesn't really produce any product.
Well, it doesn't. Well, its users do. People like you and me that tweet every day create the product, and then they put the advertising next to it. But, you know, Twitter is on schedule to make $600 to $640 million in revenue this year from sponsored tweets, sponsored posts, sponsored Twitter accounts. And next year, they're expected to go over $1 billion.
And just to talk about the actual product that's out there, I mean, it started out to some extent with, as you point out, a division between a couple of the founders, and we'll talk about the founders, between should be us or should be you, I mean, in terms of who's being tweeted here or whose news is going out there.
Yeah, I mean, it started out, you know, the four founders that created this thing. I mean, there was essentially a lot more people in the room at the time.
And there's a dozen people, like 12 apostles.
Yeah, the 12 apostles, a bunch of hackers and programmers and so on. But there were four main characters that were responsible for what this was. There was Evan Williams from a small farm town in Clarks, Nebraska, a population of almost 300 people, which is pretty small. Biz Stone, who came from Boston, and he grew up on welfare. And he came out to San Francisco in search of the modern-day gold rush dream, the tech boom. There's Jack Dorsey, who came from St. Louis. He was a very strange character. He used to walk around San Francisco with he would sew his phone number on his T-shirt with the hopes that someone would call him.
He also was a guy who tried to imitate Steve Jobs, to put it mildly.
Well, yes, but we'll get to that. We're jumping ahead. And then there's Noah Glass, who was born on a hippie commune in Southern California. And one day his dad went out for milk and never returned. And Noah was pushed out of the company very, very early on.
All poor boys, or certainly of modest backgrounds, humble backgrounds.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's the difference. You know, everyone keeps asking this the question of what's the difference between the Facebook story and the Twitter story. And I think that one of the main differences for me in the beginning of writing this was that these were four people that all came from very different backgrounds, and they're all very human characters. You know, you look at Mark Zuckerberg, and And you kind
he's
of,
not human?
I don't think I think Jason Bourne and the Bourne Identity. I think that Mark Zuckerberg was some like CIA laboratory test that escaped and built Facebook. He's an incredibly smart and he is a voracious, you know, businessman and will, you know, stop at nothing to win. And when you look at these the guys that have started Twitter, they're all very four human characters that came from, you know, some broken homes and had no money and fought their way into creating what we have today.
Although Jack Dorsey, in your portrayal of him, you mentioned the phone number and the oddness and so forth, also comes off as somewhat egomaniacal and not exactly a sympathetic character by any stretch.
Yeah, it's really interesting. When I first set out to write this book, the characters, I wrote a proposal, as you always do, and the original version that I wrote, it portrayed Jack Dorsey as the next Steve Jobs, and I thought that he was the sole creator of Twitter and all these things. And as I started doing the reporting, I realized that was not the case, and all of those things were not the case. So first of all, the company was not just founded by Jack Dorsey; it was founded by several people that were working on ideas very similar to this for months and months and months. And then there was a clear, distinct moment between Noah Glass and Jack Dorsey in a car one night where they had this realization of creating this thing. But as the story progresses, Jack Dorsey gets pushed out of the company very early on. And he goes on this almost extreme makeover to make himself more of a Steve Jobsian character. And he starts quoting Steve Jobs. He starts wearing a uniform like him, but he doesn't attribute the quotes to Steve Jobs. And it's a pretty fascinating character portrayal of someone that starts out as one person and ends up someone completely different.
Well, he was also the one who was responsible largely for pushing out Noah Glass, who you alluded to before, and he was a guy who was answering questions with authority after he had been ousted.
Yeah, so the moment that really this all started was with Noah Glass and Jack Dorsey in a car one night, and it's late February 2006, and Noah and Jack were best friends, and they'd been out drinking and dancing, and Noah was going through a divorce, and he was going through a really difficult time because the business that he had started, Odeo, which was a podcasting company, was having trouble. And his friends were tied up into that. And so he's talking to Jack, and he says to Jack, they're talking about ideas. And Jack presents the status updating idea. And the idea was that you would be able to say what you were doing. And there were other things that were out there that were similar to that. There was a thing called Dodgeball that was created by the guy in San Francisco and New York who made Foursquare. There was a thing called Text Mob, which was being used for protests. And what Noah had this moment where he took the status idea and he put it together with his loneliness, and he thought, what if you could connect to your friends and feel less alone while you with a product like this? And that was the genesis of how this thing started.
Noah gave it the name too, didn't he?
Yeah, Noah. They were all trying to come up with names, and Noah found the name. He was going through some through the dictionary for a few days, and then his phone vibrated, and when he turned it to vibrate, it led him to the word Twitch, which led him to the word Twitter.
And none of these four really are, well, involved in any central executive way now. You got this Dick Costolo, who is presently the CEO, a guy who is a stand-up comic, and I guess he worked with Steve Carell and Tina Fey and people like that.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of high drama here, and when we meet, when we open your book, we meet Biz Stone, Christopher Stone, and vomiting into a trash can.
Oh, no, Evan Williams.
I mean, Evan Williams,
yes, yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, there's a serious kind of usurpation of his power that's going on. And that's a lot of what the story is about, is people kind of outmaneuvering each other and backstabbing each other.
Yeah, there's, so in the beginning, Jack Dorsey kind of turns on Noah Glass, and Evan Williams does too to a certain degree, and they push Noah out of the company. And partially because of his erratic behavior, he was going through a very difficult time, and partially because I think Jack thought that Twitter was his baby. It was his idea, even though it was many people's idea. And then later on, Jack Dorsey was, you know, he was running Twitter for about a year and a half, and the company was doing terribly. It was the site kept crashing. They had these text messaging bills that were nearing $100,000-$200,000 a month. There were all these problems, and so Evan Williams and the board, which was made up of Fred Wilson and Bijan Sabet, they set out to to push out Jack, and they fired Jack at a very dramatic moment in the book at the Clift Hotel.
They kind of tried to erase him too, didn't they?
Well, they didn't try to erase him, but what he was fired from the company, and they gave him what they called a silent chairman role, so he didn't have voting rights for the company. But he told everyone in the media, and they told everyone, that it was a chairman role. But he kind of took it to Jack Dorsey took it to a whole separate extreme. He started to go out and do press interviews talking about what was going on at the company, even though he had no idea what was happening on a day-to-day basis there. And it became a very contentious situation between the founders, where you had, you know, Jack Dorsey out there claiming credit and quote unquote saying he was the inventor of Twitter, and Evan Williams and Biz Stone trying to suppress that and talk about what was really happening at the company and their involvement. And so it became almost an arms race for press between them.
We're talking, if you just joined us, with Nick Bilton, who is a columnist and reporter for the New York Times and the author of a new book all about Twitter. Twitter's rocky rise to fame is the subject of the book, and the book is called Hatching Twitter, and it explores the rocky history of not only the founders, but the company's complicated rise to fame and fortune, which, as I said earlier, came out of the phoenix rising of the ashes of Odeo.
Yeah, so Odeo was really interesting because it was trying to disrupt radio. It wanted to erase your job. So you're lucky.
Little did they know what they were up against.
So they created this podcasting company, and the goal was to actually create an alternative to radio where anyone could have their own radio station online. And one afternoon, Steve Jobs from Apple announced podcasting in a press release and said, "Apple brings podcasting mainstream." And literally overnight, Odeo was made, you know, obsolete. And so they set out to try to build these other ideas and explore. They had these hack days in the office. They had meetings and drinks and parties and all these things to try to discuss these different concepts of what they could bring out of it. And, excuse me. And one of the big things that they had come up with was this thing, a friendship model. And they called it groups. And it was essentially the thing that led to the followers that we have on Twitter today. So then they took that and they melded it with Jack Dorsey's idea of the status updater. And there were these two guys that worked at Odeo and Twitter, Blaine and Rabble, and they were anarchists. And they had done a lot of work with text messaging and protests for presidential elections and so on. And then they took Noah Glass's idea of feeling less alone, and also Evan Williams and Biz Stone of their concept of blogging. And so all of these things together were each one little recipe that made up what Twitter is today. And I think that the story in the book, what happened was Jack Dorsey tried to take full credit for this thing and essentially erased everyone else out of the story. And what I tried to tell was the real story of how this all started.
And Dorsey also was an anarchist. And it prompts me to ask you about the politics of these four, because, as we've said, they came from humble backgrounds. And yet now we've got, in fact, we're talking about gentrification in the next hour. We've got all this protest that's been going on about thousands of families being displaced, and not only working people, but seniors in San Francisco, Ellis evictions and so forth. And Twitter being, anti-union in terms of security contractors doesn't exactly seem to be in the progressive mode of things.
Well, it's true. I think that, you know, it's interesting because when you look at Dorsey's, and when he was in his late 20s, he had a blog or a website, and he would write about, you know, how banking was bad and how the feminism was good and all. He was a very extreme individual at that point in time, and now, you know, he runs Square, which is a banking company, and he and I wouldn't necessarily say that he's promoting those ideals anymore. At least he's not doing it publicly. But I think that what is interesting is, you know, last week you did see this. You saw this divide of where this thing came from, these people that all had very distinct ideals of trying to make the world a better place, and the technology could do that. And you know, Rabble is an interesting character in the book because he's one of the people that really kind of starts hiring all of these kind of hacker activist guys. And there's actually a moment, there's a really great story where there were two different people they were going to hire One of them was actually Jack Dorsey, and another was as this corporate guy. And everyone was like, we don't want a corporate guy in this office. It could, you know, we'd have to have meetings. We don't want to have meetings. And I think that it's fascinating to see, you know, a lot of these people that work there are still the same. They still have those same beliefs, but some of them have changed dramatically.
We're talking again with Nick Bilton. There's there's a kind of loneliness that you mentioned before that's an undergirding of this story.
Yeah, so this was the thing that...
You're too old to remember Paul Anka's I'm Just a Lonely Boy, but I couldn't help thinking about that.
I'm too old, excuse me.
Yeah. I'm too old. I do remember.
I don't know that reference. I'll Google it when I'm done.
These are lonely guys. I mean, in a sense,
yeah. So this was really fascinating to me when I set out to write this. I had no idea this was going to be part of the story, but I kept hearing this theme of loneliness, of feeling alone, of technology solving that problem, and I think that one of the things that I found for all of these characters in the story was that they all came from these backgrounds that were you know, they had a connection with technology. They found solace with technology. They found connections to people in forums through that. And, you know, Evan Williams, who created Blogger, there was a point where that was his connection to the world, where he was broke. He had no friends. And these characters are all very lonely, and that's what leads them to these technologies. And I think that what was really fascinating was the Noah Glass story, because the very first blog post that was ever written about Twitter, it was Noah Glass who'd written it, and he'd explained the moment that he came up with the name. And he said, you know, people keep asking me what this Twitter thing is, and I always believe it's something that can, quote unquote, make me feel less alone. And in the end, you know, Noah gets pushed out. And he believes that this thing will be able to connect him to his friends, but his friends are the ones that push him out. And he goes through this incredibly difficult time of not being able to use this thing that he created to connect with them, and ends up feeling even more alone. But in the end of the story, and I don't want to give away the ending because it's very exciting, he's the one, I think, that really learns the importance of technology and where it can be used. And curing loneliness is not one of those places.
You see him as kind of a victim and Dorsey as kind of a villain?
You know, it's interesting. I think that readers have a different response. You know, I have a friend in Hollywood that read it, and he's, you know, he's a big Hollywood guy. He's very kind of effervescent and excited and businesslike. And he saw the Dorsey character as, you know, he said, well, look, he had to do what he had to do. And I admire that. I think that most people, though, feel very, very bad for Noah because he was pushed out.
Your friend has a Hollywood ethos.
Exactly. He has a very Hollywood ethos. You know, I think a lot of people feel very bad for Noah because he was, you know, when I interviewed him, I remember that there was one line that kind of broke my heart a little bit. And he said, you know, more than fame and more than fortune, I just wanted friends.
Go back to the opening of your book, though. I mean, it's an opening that grabs readers. And we should say that the financing of Twitter came from Ev Williams, from selling Blogger to Google. But
that's correct.
The opening with him, like I said, you know, vomiting because of all this anxiety he's going through.
Yeah. So the opening scene is it's October 2010 and October 4th, 2010, 10:43 a.m. The scene starts with Evan Williams telling a woman in his office doorway to get out because he's going to throw up, and she steps back and closes the door, and you can hear the rustling of the trees outside, and this is it. This is his last act of CEO of Twitter, and it then kind of explains what's going on and what has happened, and he's being forced to resign by the board and some of the people that were once his friends who had turned on him. And it's the beginning of the story, but it kind of then we go back to 1996 when Evan arrives in San Francisco and we follow the story through back to that moment.
There's a lot of research went into this book. I mean, not only the interviews you did, but you went back and read a lot of IMs and emails, confidential legal papers and the likes, notes, and also a lot of tweets.
Yes, so that was another fascinating part for me, which has given me actually pause a little bit to really kind of double think what I'm going to tweet and share online. But one of the things that was really fascinating, so I did 65 hours of interviews with the founders and board members. In addition to that, I did hundreds of hours of interviews with early employees, with their spouses, with people that are still at the company in some regards, and a variety of others. And one of the things that I found truly fascinating were that stories a lot of the times the stories overlapped, but there were instances where the stories didn't overlap. And the best way that I could find the accuracy was through social media. And so I hired a researcher to help me go through the first year of tweets from the first 100 or so users of the service, which were usually the Jack Dorseys and Biz Stones of the world. And we were able to pinpoint with exact accuracy where people were. We could look through Flickr photos to find out what they were wearing. We could see videos on YouTube to see what they were saying. We could find their Foursquare check-ins to understand where they were. We can see their when on Facebook they became friends with each other to understand when they met and where they met. And it literally just painted this ultimately accurate detail.
It's like a black box almost.
It was amazing. I felt like there was a point where, the point where Jack Dorsey pushes out Noah Glass, which was a story no one knew. The story had always been portrayed that Evan Williams had done it. And I found out that it was different because I got access to, through my reporting, to an email that was sent to the board by Evan Williams, and it had, the day that Noah had been fired, and it said, I had to let Noah go today, and the reason was, and you can't repeat this, but the reason was Jack Dorsey, said he couldn't deal with it anymore, and he wouldn't stick around if Noah did. And so I took that, and I obviously went and talked to all the people involved and heard their side of it, and it was all accurate and so on. But what was even more interesting was because I had the date of the email, I went to go and look on Twitter, and I looked at where everyone was that evening. And Jack and Noah had tweeted they were out dancing and drinking together. So I went back, and I found out that they had a discussion about it, but Jack never said that he was involved in that. And I think that for me, without Twitter, I never would have been able to find that out. And I don't think they would have remembered what they had done that evening. And it was really fascinating to understand that these people in sharing this stuff online almost helped me write the book about what they were doing in the past.
That's still good sleuth work. And again, Nick Bilton is our guest. His book is Hatching Twitter. And should mention, in fact, that there is the only one that doesn't have lasting enmity in these four is Christopher Biz Stone. But also, Nick Bilton is responsible for something called the Bilton Rule, which is now cast him into some kind of immortality, perhaps not. But this came out of your columns on electronic devices on planes.
Yeah, so about late 2011, I was flying. It was Thanksgiving, and I was flying to see some family. And I had was deep in a book on my Kindle, and I didn't a few pages from the end, and the announcement came over the loudspeaker: "Please shut off your devices for takeoff and landing." And I used to skydive, so I know a little bit about planes. I have done some electrical engineering, so know a little bit about devices. And I thought to myself, this is insane. This Kindle is essentially a glorified calculator. There is nothing coming off this that could harm a plane. Why are we being told to turn these down and turn these off? And so I wrote a column for the New York Times asking the question why. And it was the most read piece I've ever written before. It was generated hundreds and hundreds of comments. It was the most emailed, most viewed. It was shared tens of thousands of times on Twitter and Facebook. And I realized it wasn't just me that was upset about this. And so we did some tests at some laboratories, and I started just writing almost a monthly column about the FAA rules and why they existed and why they were—they made no sense whatsoever. And finally, a couple of weeks ago, the FAA overturned the rule, and now you're going to be able to use devices on airplanes.
It must be great to feel that you made a difference that way. You, our listeners, can also make a difference. You can join this conversation. Let me tell you how you can do that. We are talking to Nick Bilton and, again, talking about Twitter. And I'd particularly like to hear from Twitter employees, people who work for Twitter or have worked for Twitter, but also if you have questions about the whole history of what is called hatching Twitter, the egg that hatched here, golden egg, give us a call, 866-733-6786. We welcome your calls. Again, that's 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, or tweet us, our Twitter handle, @kqedforum. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking with New York Times columnist and reporter Nick Bilton, who is the author of Hatching Twitter, and talking about a lot of things not only related to the history of Twitter. It is a soap opera and a drama and quite a narrative. And Also asking questions about that you may have about the IPO, about, well, the tax-free status or opinions you may have about that. There's certainly been a great deal of controversy going on around Twitter, and it continues. And as I said, not only talking about the protests and the tax breaks that Mayor Lee extended, but also we're going to be talking about gentrification in the next hour, and you may want to weigh in on the effect of Twitter on that score. But we certainly would like to hear from you, especially if you have questions about the company's complicated rise to fame and fortune. Our toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786. And again, particularly interested in maybe hearing from some of you who have worked at Twitter or have had some contact with some of the major figures who are part of this history. Or are presently working at Twitter. Our toll-free number is not only available, so is our email address, forum@kqed.org, and there are a number of other ways you can communicate with us. Email us or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. And you can also, of course, tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. Here's what Kara Swisher from All Things D said about your book. Essentially, it's like a Spanish telenovela over there at Twitter, except it's all dudes falling in and out of bromances.
That's Kara for you. She's right.
She's got a point, I mean, doesn't she?
She has an absolute point. You know, it's these were four friends that that you know used to spend a lot of time together and had a very tight friendship, and now not so much. You know, but they some of them got really rich, became billionaires, and even celebrities, and some of them ended up with nothing. So I don't know if that usually happens in the Spanish telenovelas.
And by the way, a listener called in to say that Lonely Boy was written and sung by Andrew Gold, not Paul Anka. You are wrong. It was done originally by Paul Anka. When it comes to rock trivia, I always hold my own and will with anyone. Here's a listener who says, have you had any interaction with Jack Dorsey since your book was finalized?
I have not spoken to Jack since the book actually came out. We did email back and forth when the New York Times Magazine excerpt came out, but I can't really talk about what we discussed. But I have spoken to some of the other founders, and I think that and not even just the other founders, but the venture capitalists, early employees, and so on, and I would say 95.6% of them have said that they appreciate the fact that this is a story that is including everyone and their role in this. And they also have said I ran into one of the founders yesterday who said I was amazed at how surprisingly accurate everything was. And I don't know if that was a diss or if that was
a
compliment. So, yeah.
But, you know, it's amazing that this company came into fruition and has had such a success, not only because of the acrimony and difficulty in the relationships, because also it was kind of a mess and really chaotic in so many respects.
Yeah, you know, Biff Stone said to me at one point that he believes that part of the chaos was what made it so successful. So the site kept crashing in 2007, 2008, even 2009. It would go down.
It was like Obamacare.
It was Obamacare, yeah. So maybe that'll be a success. It was just continually in the blogosphere and in the news that Twitter was down and Twitter wasn't working. But what Biz said was as a result of that, there were a small segment of people that cared about it. It was very small, but they were the ones that were very vociferous about when the site would break, and it would lead other people to it. So it's almost like if everyone's saying this thing's not working, everyone else is like, well, I have to find out what this thing is. You know, if everyone's complaining about this thing being broken, I need to go and do that. And he actually believes that a big part of the success in the early days was the fact that the site kept going down.
There's also been a great deal made out of the fact that Twitter played and certainly did play a role in the Middle East and the Arab Spring that, you know, continues to play a role in terms of news and so forth. How do you see it? I mean, just from your perspective, having done all this research, just in terms of being some kind of fulcrum and at the center of vortex of big events like that.
So someone asked me the other day what's my favorite scene in the book, and it's actually two scenes, and it relates to this. And so in 2007, the founders went out to South by Southwest, the music and technology festival, and that year Twitter ended up winning as the best new startup. And there was a point when all of the founders, not including Noah because he had been cast out at this point, but where the other founders were in a bar. And and they heard everyone's phones going ding, 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 and they were getting text messages, and all of a sudden everyone started rushing out of the bar, and it was just literally like some kind of notification to come in, and one of the guys grabbed someone and said, "Where are you guys going?" And they said, "Oh, we heard on Twitter that there's a party with free beer down the road." And they actually referred to this as flocking. So 2 years later, the same exact action was being used in the Iranian Revolution. And what was happening were people were using text messaging and Twitter to organize protests and tell people where to go with those. And I just found that it was so fascinating to see that this thing that in 2007 was being used to find free beer was being used 2 years later to overthrow governments or to attempt to. And it really kind of showed the magnitude of how much this thing grew and how quickly it grew. And I think that it's going to continue to have that kind of effect on the world. The question is that I have, and I don't know the answer to this, is as a public company, is Twitter going to care about those kind of use cases as much as it's going to care about advertising dollars?
Well, we'll hear from listeners, no doubt, on that, as well as just getting a gauge of what your feelings are about Twitter, particularly in light of not only the tax break and the protests that went on, but also in light of the IPO and, well, this story we're talking about with Nick Bilton. And again, may want to weigh in here. We welcome you to the conversation, especially those of you who maybe had some experience working for this company or remember back in its early days what it was about or are there now. Again, you can join us toll-free at 866-733-6786. Laura, you were with Twitter early on?
Laura.
Laura?
I was.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yes, I was. I was a founding team member of the international team.
Hi, Laura.
So tell us.
It was amazing.
What was it like back then?
I joined right during the Iranian Revolution and understanding the importance of Twitter, not just domestically, but internationally. And this always used to say that Twitter was never the triumph of technology. It was a triumph of humanity. And that was very instilled in a lot of us early employees as we were building this product, that people felt it was useless or it was just social media. And we felt like it was building something forward. So it was definitely an amazing time. And when that shift happened, when Ev was no longer there, it was a very drastic shift to a lot of employees that were building something that they wanted more. And now it feels surreal now that we are all stakeholders in the company, now that it's public, that people are asking us about how we feel about being millionaires. It's something that is very surreal to us.
Are you still at the company?
No, I left. Because of that shift, I wanted Twitter to be something more than I think what it's going to be, but I'm definitely thankful for the opportunity to have.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting. I think that, you know, the Evan Williams, I think in the story he tells, the part of the reason that he's pushed out and that scene happens in the beginning is because he is so focused on the product and the company, and he's not necessarily focused on the business. And there were these moments where Ev and Biz and Jason Goldman, who's another one of the early employees, they were very adamant about the use cases of Twitter. And during the Iranian Revolution, for example, the media kept calling and saying, "We need someone from Twitter to come on the news, on the radio, and whatever." And Biz and Ev and Goldman said, "No, we don't want to be seen as taking a side in anything. We want this to be a technology that is being used for everything." And they were very, very adamant about that. And I think that was one of the big problems that they had and the differences with Jack Dorsey, who was happy to talk about anything in the media, whether it was Twitter being used in politics and revolutions or whatever. And I think that ethos that they first originally instilled in the company, Ev and those guys, I wonder, as the listener said, if it will still be there in the future.
Well, again, like to hear from our listeners on this. Also like to hear from some of you who are investors or fancy yourself investors. Did you buy shares of Twitter? And if so, why? And if not, why not? And if you're a Twitter user, what do you think about the service and how it's changed over the years? And what hopes or fears do you have about the IPO? We'll get some more callers in here. I thank Laura for hers. Go next to Palo Alto. Betty, you're our next caller. Good morning. I'm sorry, Betty. We're not understanding you. We'll see if we can get a better line there, or find out. What are you getting any response from investors at this point?
You know, it's. I think a lot of people keep emailing me and asking me what I think the stock will end up being, and I can't answer that question.
Nor should you.
Nor should I. But I think that there's, you know, investors want to know what this company is, and I think that for me, I actually tell them, read the book. You know, you have to understand the future of Twitter, you have to understand the past of Twitter. And you asked in the very beginning, we actually didn't get to answering this question, but you asked that what was Twitter? These two guys had it, two different viewpoints of what it was. And that's a big part of the drama within the story. It's a story, you know, where Evan Williams sees this company as a way to talk about what's happening around you. He sees it as a way to say, it's almost like a news aggregator. So you say there's a fire across the street, I just read this great article. And Jack Dorsey saw it in a very different way. He saw it as a way to talk about what was happening to him, and to say, I'm on the radio or I'm eating a hamburger. And I think that those two things together are what make Twitter. And I think that for investors, they kind of need to really understand that before they go off and buy the stock. This is not just a company where you're going to look just at the revenue models. You should really be looking at what the creation models were with this and how people use it and how that may change in the future. And we really don't know what it will be tomorrow versus what it was yesterday.
Well, a lot of it has become sort of celebrity connected. And what's curious, you can't help getting away from the fact that, like, when people are in a car, they are somehow more vulnerable to road rage. When they're on the computer, they're more vulnerable to flaming. And they're more vulnerable, it seems, when they tweet to putting out impulsive things that they necessarily aren't going to be happy about.
Absolutely. Yeah, I've had unbelievable reviews for the book, but there was one the other day that wasn't very good, and it was factually incorrect. And I wrote an email to this person, and I was kind of scathing them for this review, and then I hit delete because I knew I shouldn't send it. And I think that that's something I've learned to do from Twitter. You know, I've every time I...
You know, I've been famous for something other than the airplane electronics.
Yeah, exactly. So I think that every time I... on Twitter, someone responds to me about something and they say something negative. Your initial reaction is to be like, rah! But every time you get into a debate with someone on Twitter, it's almost like you sleep with someone, you meet in a bar, and you wake up in the morning, you're like, oh my God, what did I just do? Because you can't erase it, and it's there. And I've learned that if I'm going to respond to someone, I need to give it 12 hours to cool down. And this immediacy, while it's wonderful for actually consuming news, it can be terrible for your emotions.
Let's get another caller on. Frank, join us. You're on.
Good morning. I wanted to talk a little bit about your comment about Twitter being value neutral. I'm a lawyer, and a year ago, I had a case where there was a parody account in England where the user was flaming the owner of The Guardian, the Newscliff media. And Newscliff sued Twitter to try to get his identity. And in my research and in talking to Twitter's legal staff, it turns out that sometimes the company itself would defend that anonymity, would say you can't have it, and in some cases they would leave it up to the user to go find a lawyer, and they seem to be taking a position that we'll defend the political ones, but we won't defend the parodies, sort of inside the house fight. Do you see them going public as changing that issue because of things like government pressure?
It's a great question, and it's funny. A friend of mine and I, who's at Stanford, we always get into this debate, and he believes that Twitter is not neutral, and that it makes decisions based on its own interests, and I believe that it is neutral, and makes decisions based on its users. But as you just said, you know, they will defend certain accounts and they will not defend others, and so there is a decision being made. The one thing that that's happened recently is one of the lawyers. His name is AMAC on Twitter, and that's what everyone calls him. He was one of the big proponents for respecting the user and the privacy and free speech and so on. And he actually has left the company. And my big question, as someone who covers the company for the New York Times, still is who is that voice within Twitter? And
I was just going to ask, do they have any? Google keeps saying do no evil. Do they have any?
Well, this is what happens. These companies start out with these wonderful philosophies of making the world a better place and so on, and then they become public. And then they have investors and the money, and there are all these questions of, you know, the investors are not going to say, well, why didn't you defend this user? They're going to say, well, why is my stock falling? And so
money corrupts, and more money, your absolute money corrupts absolutely.
Absolutely, I think it does. And I think that the question I actually cannot answer, and I don't think we can, is will Twitter still be a good company with its good moral values in the next 5 years? And I don't know.
Of course, you read the story of these four guys, good moral values. I mean, it's pretty messy, and it's also filled with a lot of drama, admittedly, but also a lot of, like I said, backstabbing.
Yep, that's correct. It really is a story of four friends that, you know, but it's not unique to Twitter. You know, I think what is unique to Twitter is that it was four people that pushed each other out of the company. One of them, of course, was not really involved, but it was these friends that pushed each other out one by one by one by one, right? And whereas in the Valley we call this the creation myth, right? It's this myth of a startup that has this story of we started on the back of a napkin and became a multi-billion-dollar company that changed the world. That's not the case ever, period. You know, if you look today, you have Foursquare where there was turmoil between those two founders. You have Facebook where you had Edward Saverin who was pushed out. You have Snapchat that's being sued right now by its founders. I mean, literally every single company has this story.
I'm sorry, kind of thinking about you making the allusion that so many have to the gold rush, these guys coming out here because they want to be part of the gold rush.
Yep.
It's like the treasure of Sierra Madre. Once they find the gold, they're fighting each other.
Well, that's exactly what happens. And I think it's not just about the money. It's about the power and the influence too.
And we'll bring Betty. Let's hope your phone works this time. Hi.
Hi.
Okay, good.
So that's really funny because that's exactly what I was just calling about. Barracuda went public last week also, and Dean Draker, who's the founding member and really should be credited for the entire company, was booted out last week. And I just thought it was very coincidental that these two happened within 2 days of each other.
Yeah, it's a story that I would like to say it's unique to the Valley, but I don't think it is. But what is unique to the Valley is that they have this bizarre way of hiring these massive public relations teams and people that try to cover up the drama. And what's different, I think, in New York and in the media world and in the finance world is they admit it. They say, you know what, we're in it for the money. You know, we push this person out because they're not very good or whatever the reason is. And yet in the Valley, there's this complete and utter nonsense that exists, that everything is just perfect and hunky-dory. And the reality is there's backstabbing. There's people pushing each other out. There's vying for control between people that were once friends. And nowhere is this more apparent than with the Twitter story.
And Betty, we thank you for the call. Let me go to some emails here. Derek from Oakland writes, how will Twitter make money? I suggest a subscription service where I pay $5 a year and I'm spared all ads in my timeline.
I actually think that's a great idea. Some people have said that Facebook should do the same thing, where you can pay X amount of dollars per year and you don't have to see ads. But the problem is all of these services require snooping through your tweets and your location and all these things to be able to make more money off you. So it is not in their best interest. With Twitter, the way they make money is through sponsored advertisements and sponsored tweets and sponsored posts. And so, for example, I did one last week where I tweeted a link to the website for my book and a picture of the book and said, you know, buy Hatching Twitter at hatchingtwitter.com, and then I can promote it. So I pay for not just my followers to see it, but for people that are maybe, let's say they live in San Francisco and have tweeted about the word book before. And so therefore I can highlight that tweet just for those users, and then I pay for each person that actually interacts with it.
Another listener writes, this story breaks my heart and sends chills up my spine. I worked for years in Silicon Valley and was very put off by the ethics. At the risk of sounding like an aging baby boomer, if this is the generation set to inherit the world, take me back to the 60s.
Well, come on. Let's go back to the 60s. You think there was no fighting then? I mean, it was a different world because it wasn't Silicon Valley, but it was people, you know, pushing each other. I mean, look at Mad Men, you know, look at the politics.
Well, before
back then.
The '60s, the '60s was more of, I dislike these kind of homogenizing of decades, but Susan Sontag warned us against that. The '60s was more rebellion against a lot of the Mad Men stuff, which is more of the '50s in many ways. But, I'm not trying to liberate the '60s, but it was a liberating
decade. As much as it sounds wonderful in hindsight, I can't imagine that there wasn't people pushing each other out of businesses back then.
Well, as somebody who was involved in what we used to call the movement, there were people pushing each other for power in that.
In the movements, yeah.
John writes, I still do not use Twitter. Yes, I have an account. Very occasionally do I look at it. What am I missing? Seems unnecessary to me, but I know it's gaining in importance as a credible source for news events. What is Nick Bilton's take on its future?
Well, I think, you know, Twitter can be whatever you want it to be. For me, I use it as a way to share the stories that I write. I use it as a way to interact with the readers. I use it as a way to consume news. I follow a lot of news services. I follow a lot of columnists I really like. One of my favorite use cases, actually, is I follow a bunch of astronauts in space who tweet pictures of the Earth, and it's something I can never ever touch and never actually see in real life, but I get to consume that through the eyes of these people 250 miles above the Earth. But you know, I have a sister who just follows celebrity accounts. I have a friend who just follows weather and traffic related Twitter accounts. And I think that's what the beauty of Twitter is you can use it for whatever you want. You know, the Pope is on there now. The Pope tweets every few days something, you know, that would used to be said in a sermon. You have presidents on there. You have the U.S. president, the president of Iran, having conversations. You have Mike Tyson.
Members of the United States Congress, like Anthony Weiner.
Yeah, you have that. You have drama. You have excitement. You have. You know, I think that's what makes Twitter so special. It's like a TV station where there's 240 million channels, and you get to decide which ones you want to watch.
Ryan writes, I enjoy how your guest cites the amount of revenue Twitter has and may have next year as opposed to net income. Why is Twitter not a total fad perpetuated by yet another financial bubble and speculative tech stocks, LinkedIn, Facebook, Netflix, Amazon?
Well, LinkedIn, Netflix, Facebook, Amazon, all those guys, they are profitable companies, right? They're companies that are public and are making profits, and the revenues are continuing to increase and across the board. And I think that that being said, though, there are on the other side of that line, there are the bubble companies that are startups that you look at and think, how on earth did these guys get so much funding and are worth so much? And I do absolutely believe that we are in another bubble, and it is going to pop. You cannot, you know, I mean, just I wrote a column a couple of weeks ago where I noted that all of these companies are valued at $1 billion or more. So you have Fab.com, $1 billion. You have Snapchat, which is supposedly coming up at $3.6 billion. You have Pinterest at $3.8 billion. You have Square at $3.5 billion. All these companies, and none of them are profitable. And some of them don't even make any revenue. So how is this sustainable? So eventually, some of these companies are either going to have to sell to someone, which you can't do when you're worth that much money, right? There's only a couple of suitors that can come along when you're in the multi-billion dollar range, or they're going to pop.
Well, it's like Bubble 1.0. You remember all those companies, pet food and the like?
Pets.com,
Leo asks, Nick, can you discuss the circumstances under which Twitter's internal strategy was leaked in 2009 and how that affected the company's founders?
Yeah, there was a moment in 2009 where everything was hacked. Their servers, their email addresses and so on, and they got access to all these internal documents and payroll, and it was a disaster. And what happened was it turned out that someone had figured out one of the passwords for someone's email address and had reset a bunch of things and so on. It was a pretty bad moment for the company. I think it showed just the chaos that was going on internally and how this wasn't a company that had fully grown up. Actually, there's a great moment that actually did not make it into the book, but P. Diddy had once tried to buy the company, the rapper P. Diddy, and he had sent this email to Evan Williams, and the email had been, you know, there was an email back and forth that had been leaked and in that hacking, and P. Diddy was not very happy about it when it came out that the company was hacked. But ultimately, that moment, you know, it didn't really affect Twitter. It was, I think, a story that kind of largely stayed within the valley, because a lot of what the most important documents that were leaked were essentially projections, and you know, projections can be anything. You can make them up. You know, I could project that my book will sell a million copies. It doesn't mean it's going to actually do it.
It wasn't only P. Diddy, by the way. There were a lot of people who tried to get in on the action, as you account for in your book. I mean, Gore wanted to be a partner.
There's a great scene.
Your friend Zuckerberg and Arnold Schwarzenegger and on.
Yeah, there's a great scene where Al Gore in the book, he invites Evan Williams and Biz Stone to his place at the St. Regis, and he gets them drunk and wines and dines them and tries to convince them to sell him part of Twitter and actually merge Current TV and Twitter together to create Twitter TV. And Biz Stone, who's very, very drunk, politely declines. But at the very end of the evening, Al Gore goes in the kitchen and comes out with a bottle of Patron and he says, I hear this is the good stuff. And they do shots of Patron together. So there was just story after story like that in the book.
There's some good stories in this book. A lot of good stories. Noah Glass, who you have said reminds you a little bit of Kramer and Seinfeld, the horse story of his uncle, it's just kind of priceless in its own right.
Yeah, there's, I think when you kind of write these stories, you have to figure out ways to tell past narratives that really define how these people became who they were. And there's one moment in the Noah Glass story where he's on his grandfather's farm and one of his family members, there's a horse that kicks his brother, and one of the family members comes out and grabs a pipe and literally beats the horse to death and says to the boys, like, you have to learn to stand up for yourself.
For animal lovers, it's a horrible story.
Yeah, well, it's a horrible story, but it's without a doubt. But I think that it was a moment for me because you have this kid being taught this lesson, right, to stand up for himself. But in the end, when he is essentially kicked by a horse, when he is told he's pushed out of the company by his friends, he doesn't fight back because he wasn't wired that way. He was, he's an artist. He was somebody that probably, should have been around in the 60s, as we discussed earlier. He wasn't someone that was capable of fighting back.
Just clarify something on the web. Melissa writes, the speaker and an earlier caller who worked on Twitter's international team keep referring to its role in the Iranian Revolution. Really? Was it 1979? There were protests and uprising in 2009, but Ahmadinejad stayed in power and the regime remains. Do they not know, or just repeating the messages symptomatic of the hype and overdetermination of Twitter's importance to humanity? Well, that was called the Green Revolution in 2009.
It was called. So the caller's right. I think that, there were countries where it did actually help overthrow those governments. And I interviewed people at the State Department, at the White House, that all talked about the importance of the role of Twitter.
Quick question from Bill. Is Nick going to take over for David Pogue as tech guru at the New York Times? And what does Nick have in the pipeline? What are you working on now?
I'm a columnist at the New York Times already, so I'm quite happy doing my column Disruptions. But I'm exploring some other book ideas. I really, really enjoyed writing this book.
And this will be a movie. I guarantee you that. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for
Twitter is the book by Nick Bilton. And we're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. I want to thank our senior editor, Dan Zoll, and our producers, Irene Gucci, Tina Lauerberg, Amanda Stupai. Our engineer is Danny Bringer, and our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. For all of us at KQED, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of Clos Pegas Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.